Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 8th of June, as we record. The sun is shining and we are again happy to be ensconced in the building basement to discuss the latest goings on in UK markets. I know that sounds a bit like a hostage message, but it is true, I assure you. Today we are discussing electrical components maker Discover IE. We are looking at the prospect of a new normal for interest rates, a big new listing on the London market, and we might also delve into some crypto news if there's time to. Joining me to discuss all this are, as per usual, over the line, Mark Robinson. Hi, Mark.
Oh, good morning, Dan.
In the studio, we have our economics writer, Hermione Taylor.
Hello, delighted to be here.
And our news editor and commodities correspondent, Alex Hamer.
Hello.
So we'll start with Discover IE, a terrible name, of course, but it is at least memorable, I suppose, sort of. It stands for Discover Innovative Electronics. And in fairness, a fair few people did seem to discover it yesterday when it rallied fairly strongly on the back of its full year figures for the 12 months to the end of March. Mark, you covered those figures. Talk us through them to kick things off.
Yeah, sure. This is only the second time that I've had a look at the company, and I had quite a lengthy chat with management. And you were left with the impression that they were very pleased with the results, other than the sort of, you know, the usual expectations there. They finished the period with the order book was at a higher level than expected, which was good. There was an accompanying 10% increase in organic sales. The book-to-bill ratio, which I noted in the piece as well, came in at 0.96. Now, under normal circumstances, that might be some cause for concern, given that more units were shipped than billed during the period, but they were coming off an extremely strong comparator as well. So on balance, it was actually a pretty good result there. Yeah, so it was a decent run out for them as well. If you look at across their different markets, the UK, Europe, and North America all saw double-digit sales growth. The outlier was the Asian market, or specifically China, which saw a fairly heavy dip in organic sales over that period. That was down to supply chain bottlenecks for the most part. And we all know what happened in China towards the end of last year as well. So that wasn't that much of a surprise all up. The underlying profits, that was up by a quarter to 51.8 million. And the related margin was also up too. So from an operational perspective, and in fact, in terms of the financial performance, it's no wonder that management were quite happy with affairs.
Yeah, I suppose the context for these results as well show the kind of backdrop we are in, because as is common, they had a full year trading update just a couple of months ago, which, you know, was similarly bullish, saying results are ahead of expectations. And yet the figures yesterday, Wednesday, this is, were strong enough to spark that new rally. I suppose that shows that, you know, people are concerned about any signs of a deteriorating outlook, even in the 2 month or 6 week period between these two updates. And the fact there weren't any, and the fact that you know, business is still going pretty well, is good enough for another big markup. I mean, this is really sort of, in terms of the structure of the business, it's a supply side story, is the way you characterized it, I think.
Yeah, I think it's got some very interesting characteristics, the business itself, because as I put out, I think it is insulated to a certain degree against wider economic trends. I mean, you can't do that completely, of course, but there's an explicit management strategy, which is looking at not only those locales and regions through the world that offer high growth prospects, but also to the product ranges, which are also have growth characteristics. And given the markets that they deal in, normally consumer electronics, there's a high correlation with economic growth as well. But of course, Discover IE, they're selling into very specialist niche providers there. For instance, one of their largest customers is the German electronics giant Siemens, and they provide components for that group's MRI scanners. this is an area that isn't normally affected by wider economic trends as well, because you just don't, it's not a discretionary sort of budget item, MRI scanners. So, you know, that this is partly explains why they hold up pretty well, even if there's general economic anxieties. If you go back to the last period where we were in a genuine recession in the UK, that was at the first couple of quarters of 2020. I mean, we were still in COVID land then, of course, but the share price dipped during that period, but responded very quickly as well. So I think it does have some real defensive characteristics, even though you wouldn't think that would normally be the case with a supply of electronic components.
Yeah, I suppose in 2020, you know, it was quite a unique situation as well in terms of that big dip and rally, which we saw in a lot of companies, but also in terms of the way that businesses were affected. And, you know, each recession is different, perhaps. So we'll keep a close eye to see how those effects are changing. But the point you make about, you know, being less price sensitive, I think, is quite important. And to an extent, a lot of their components are relatively small costs proportionally for a lot of their customers as well, which should, you would think, enable them to pass on prices a bit more easily than if you're you know, a big ticket item, that kind of thing.
Yes, it's a sort of a capital light business model in many respects as well. Another reason why they're insulated against wider trends as well is that they, as you I think alluded to there, they tend to produce a lot of their in-house components too, so they're not actually that vulnerable to the supply chain problems which affected some of their demand in China itself. And when I spoke to management as well, they pointed, we had quite a lengthy discussion about supply chains, and of course the realignment of global supply chains was happening well before the pandemic, and management there had anticipated this trend, and they've rejigged the business model to reflect this as well. So it's another real positive, I think, for the business.
I mean, this is a company that goes under the radar a little bit. It is a FTSE 250 company, but not one that's always, you know, first on the agenda. But again, as mentioned, you know, the share price has performed pretty well this year, certainly after the performance yesterday. We've upgraded them to buy as well. Can we talk a little bit about the valuation case in and of itself, first of all?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit difficult when I was looking at this one as well, because it's hard because they supply in very much into sort of niche areas of the technology market. It's hard to find like with like. I know you we referenced some Peel Hunt analysis as well, and they look to similar companies such as Halma and Diploma. And said that Discover IE's rating was favorable by comparison. But I earlier on this morning, I had a look around at some other companies which bear some comparison, Gooch and Housego and XP Power. And perhaps what I should have mentioned in the valuation argument within the article was that they're cheap relative to their growth prospects. Now, this is borne out by their PEG ratio as well. And on that basis, they really are outstripping the opposition as too. So, I mean, this is the main reason why I decided to upgrade it to a buy as well. It's those growth prospects going forward, we don't think are adequately reflected in the share price. So, yeah, I mean, it's not a tremendous yield on the stock at the moment. I think the forward yield is about 1.8%. I might be wrong on that one, but I think this is a really well-run organization. It has a moat in several of its markets as well. It's not the type of components anyone can turn around and produce overnight. So definitely, I think it could be a worthwhile addition to investor portfolios.
Yeah, you mentioned Halma, you know, alluding to Peel Hunt. We were having a chat earlier about the note they put out. They are admittedly house broker, but, you know, comparing valuations with the likes of Halma, Diploma, I think Discover IE compared with its sector is maybe a little more expensive, certainly on a basic PE basis. But when you look at those kind of companies, it's, you know, it's trading at a discount. Part of that is the reason I think Peel Hunt thinks it should be compared to those is it has a similar buy and build strategy. You know, it does like to make acquisitions. Return on capital has been fairly good over the last few years. It did dip a bit last year, but it has been pretty good, which shows that, or suggests that those acquisitions have been, you know, accretive for the company. What are the, when you spoke to management, did they make any comments about, you know, further appetite, doing more deals in the months ahead?
Yeah, they're certainly looking at companies at the moment. Now, of course, they can't go into any specific detail when they're talking to me, but you certainly given the impression that they're always looking at deals. And when you look at the balance sheet as well, it's in good nick. You know, the sort of net profits represent 0.7 times cash profit. So, I mean, that gives them plenty of leeway to look at acquisitions in the market too. I would reiterate that point again, though. The rating, I mean, that is a reflection in many ways of those growth prospects. And I think that's the central point that our listeners and readers should take on board.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting yesterday, but I think it started when it was up to 3-4% at the beginning of the day and for much of the morning, and then ended up, you know, up double digits. So clearly there is, you know, interest there in those figures, and we'll be keeping a close eye as ever on the company in the months ahead. But we're going to turn to our cover story this week now. It is on interest rates. It's on, well, first of all, where are they going next? But secondly, where might they end up, all else being equal, as a, you know, a kind of a terminal rate, if you will. Hermione, you wrote this piece. There are many different terms for this, which we can get into. You know, also looking at the natural rate of interest, as it's called, quote unquote. We'll come on to that in a moment. But first of all, we should sort of talk about the immediate outlook in the UK specifically, where, you know, expectations of higher rates are certainly, you know, gathering pace again, or they have been in the last few weeks, given elevated inflation figures.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of a sudden, the end of this tightening cycle suddenly seems a lot further away than it did. Expectations have softened a bit, but markets are expecting interest rates to rise to almost 5.5%. A lot of economists think that 5.25% is where they'll settle, where they'll peak. So that potentially means three more interest rate hikes over the summer. I mean, as you say, the reason is that UK inflation hasn't fallen as quickly as we were expecting. So the expectation now is that the Bank of England is going to have to raise interest rates higher and maybe hold them there for longer to quash inflation and get it back down to target. And it looks like they will be high for a while. So if you look at market pricing, it suggests that interest rates will still be above 3.5% even in 5 years' time. So I've been looking at this question of when the tightening cycle ends and interest rates do go back to normal, what will normal even look like?
Yeah, I mean, that is the big question, isn't it? Because, as you say, there's been this debate about, or certainly at the start of the year, of, oh, we're near the peak, and, you know, might rates even be cut later in this year, given we were potentially entering a recession. We still might, of course. That has been pushed back a little bit. But the ultimate question really then is, given this, you know, decade plus of zero, or, you know, at or near the zero lower bound interest rates, very different to what we've seen in the decades before that, what does a normal environment look like if we are, hopefully, you know, out of a recession and, you know, perhaps out of an expansionary period as well, and into a more normal times? I mean, normal times never seem to arrive nowadays, but nonetheless, what is that, you know, kind of median rate? And that's kind of almost, in many ways, what you're looking at in this piece.
Yeah, well, economists think that maybe markets aren't actually right on this. And there are some theoretical reasons to think that interest rates won't actually stay as high as they are now, and definitely as high as they have been kind of in decades past. And one reason is this idea in economics of the natural rate of interest, which is very hypothetical. And it's the rate of interest that would keep an economy in a nice equilibrium of kind of low unemployment and target inflation, so sort of not too hot and not too cold. And if a central bank raises the interest rate above the natural rate, they would slow the economy down. And if the central bank cuts the interest rate below this natural rate, that should start to get the economy going again. And economists think that this natural rate has fallen in developed economies over the past 40 years, and that it might fall further still.
What are some of the reasons why why they think that has been the case. What are the factors driving that fall?
Well, the IMF just did a big report on this. And they think that in the UK, this natural rate of interest has fallen from about 2% a few decades ago to under 0.5%. They think it could fall even closer to zero. And this is really driven by the impact of an ageing population and they think slower productivity growth.
It was quite interesting. I was looking at that report as well, and they don't think the likes of, you think the big changes macroeconomically over the past few decades, the rise of China, they don't think that has affected developed economies' natural rate too much just due to offsetting factors. I suppose the next question is, what does this natural rate mean and the changes in the natural rate? What do they mean for where UK rates might settle over the medium term? I mean, this is, again, the impossible to answer question, but according to those clues, do they suggest?
Well, there's a phrase in this IMF report that said that they think that the factors that drove the low natural rate haven't gone away and they think that natural rates will stay low. Even though it sounds like it's kind of a slam dunk for returning to near zero rates, there's a really big catch, which is that when they're talking about the natural rate, they're stripping out the impacts of inflation. So that means that if inflation does go back to target to 2% and our natural rate is about 0.5%, that would mean interest rates of about 2.5%. So in theory, we could expect interest rates to hover about 2.5% in the medium term if this inflation problem is sorted out.
The question is, well, first of all, will the inflation problem be sorted out?
I mean, this is a huge question. Forecasts suggest that it will, maybe towards the end of next year. But a lot of economists think that even if it does go back down to target, the Bank of England might be quite cautious and they might be slower to cut rates back down to this natural rate because they're worried about inflation coming back up again. So because of that, we could see the interest rate staying above this kind of natural rate for a while.
Yeah, it's another reason perhaps why, getting back to normal or what we deem to be normal might not be happening anytime soon. I mean, what are the other things that could impact this natural rate, aside from the question of inflation?
Yeah, I mean, you've made a great point about the impact of China, and we've had a lot of big structural forces that have driven the natural rate of interest down over the past kind of few decades. There's no reason to think that there won't be other forces that could actually drive it back up again. So the IMF says that there are a few things to be aware of, which is deglobalization, so kind of global fracturing, a move towards green energy, and kind of the fact that we've got very high public debt at the moment could actually increase the natural rate of interest again. And even though this natural rate of interest is theoretical, that does still imply that policymakers would need to hold the interest rates they're setting higher to try and keep inflation and employment in equilibrium going forward. Lots of uncertainty.
That green economy, decarbonisation is an interesting question as well. The IMF, says, I mean, people have different opinions on, whether the transition will raise the cost of capital overall or whether you'll do the opposite. I think the IMF says higher energy prices, I'm just quoting directly from the report here, higher energy prices reflecting a combination of taxes and regulations would bring down the marginal productivity of capital. But offsetting that is, the potential need for deficit financing of the likes of, infrastructure and the subsidies that, we're starting to see come out as well could act in a different way. So, that to me seems like a big potential impact on the natural rate in the years ahead, this prospect of transition or governments attempting to transition us to a greener economy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also worth pointing out that some economists think that the kind of trends that would impact the natural rate of interest could also impact inflation as well. So things like decarbonisation and a move to a green economy could actually change where inflation settles longer term, which would have implications for interest rates as well.
That's a fair point, yeah. The inflation question is currently all important and, we'll probably continue that way for a while, but I think it is valuable to get a sense of what this means as well and what it could mean. It's probably, we do touch on in the piece, we won't go into it now, we do touch on some asset allocation implications as well, but I think that the general gist of it is very much, looking at a little bit down the line, what kind of scenario might we be facing? I think it's fair to say we're probably not going back to 0% interest rates anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, in the piece I look at, it depends the horizon that you look at. I mean, I think a lot of people in their 30s have been used to only near zero interest rates, and that's normal to them. But if you take a longer view, interest rates have sort of been much higher. They were 6% when the Bank of England was established back in the 1600s. So if you take a longer view, this idea of what normal is does look very different.
Yeah, as I say, that is our cover story this week. So if you have an interest in interest rates, which you should do, as we all do, do take a look at that. But For our next segment this week, we are going to talk about a London listing, a big potential listing in London. WE Soda, We Soda, how do you I don't know how you pronounce this company. It's a new company, a new name to us as well. But Alex, you've been looking at this, a fairly big company in terms of market cap. First of all, what does it do? It deals with soda ash.
Yeah, so it's WE Soda,
right?
AKA Q Soda, AKA a subsidiary of the China Group, a Turkish C-I-N-E-R.
Okay.
I've taken the pronunciation from previous Liverpool midfielder Emre Can, so I hope it's right. It's a Turkish company,
okay,
or conglomerate, as you might say. It owns a few media entities, TV channels, and WE Soda, which is actually a UK-registered company, hence the London listing. But for all intents and purposes, you're potentially buying into part of this bigger conglomerate that mines soda ash, as you say, which is used in, it's one of those kind of precursor almost chemicals. So it's actually, soda ash is sodium carbonate. It's used for glass manufacturing mainly, but then it goes into cleaning products, food products. It's one of those things that's all around us, but we don't really know about. And WE Soda is trying to change that.
And this is a UK listing, which in itself is notable at the moment. It's a UK incorporated business, you mentioned. That's probably one reason. Another reason is it's, you know, emerging markets focus as well. You know, Turkey has its own issues right now with the currency too. So perhaps, you know, London seems attractive for a number of reasons. It's an established market. It allows them to still access, you know, any number of their underlying markets as well. And perhaps it's, you know, a bit better in that regard than the US just geographically.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's nice that they're listing in London. Just, you know, been a bit cowed in recent months in terms of the public markets, but you can't really see a company like this wanting to go to New York. I mean, Amsterdam or Frankfurt maybe, but, you know, it knows the UK. Its CEO is a former investment banker in London. They've set up here for a reason. It's an interesting one from the investor standpoint, because I think this is a well-established business. It, you know, sales last year were 1.7 billion US. It makes a fair amount of free cash. It's listing with the idea that it's going to pay out fairly good dividends. The caveat is that only 10% of the company will only be a float of 10%. They're not raising cash. It's actually just the China Group run by Mr. China himself, and his wife will be the chair of this company. But they're just selling off, I think it was 700-800 million worth of shares, and that's just going to go back into the conglomerate to pay off intercompany debts. So you're kind of buying into this broader company. It's not like, you know, say a traditional mining float. You know, we've had a few come over in recent years, something like Endeavour Mining, big gold miner. It's, you're investing 100% in that. There's a big float, liquidity is pretty good. This is a quite a different story to that. There aren't many comparators, so it's a bit hard to stick a valuation on it, but I think estimates so far are a 7.5 billion market cap, which would take it into the FTSE 100. And with that 10% float, it would meet the minimum requirements there. It might go up to a 15% float, but it's a public-ish company. And I think, you know, a comparison might be Solvay, which is a Belgian chemicals company. They have a much broader range of products, but they're another big producer of soda ash. They're valued about 8x forward earnings. But yeah, there's no direct comparison really.
There is also a retail offer via primary bid, albeit fairly small.
Yeah, I think so. Their retail investors will have, and there's 8 million euros that they're looking to raise through that platform. That will obviously be a pretty small proportion of what they're selling. But I think, you know, there are a few regulations they're coming up against here, and that 8 million is about the cap of where they can go. I don't know. It's kind of throwing a bone to the retail investors who often get left out of these processes. And what I'm really interested to see is actually the liquidity and actually and trading volumes that they can manage. We're still a while away from this actually happening. I mean, last week was the intention to float. This week we got the confirmation of intention to float with their list of 8 banks who are all, I'm sure, working very hard. I mean, we already got a nice bit of marketing from Liberum, who's on it, talking about the soda market. Obviously, you know, helpfully for their client, the market is forecast to go into deficit. You know, who would have thought? But it's, you know, it's had about 1% growth a year in demand. It's kind of ticking along. It's not a very liquid market. It's long-term contracts. They're mainly selling to China. Yeah, and WE Soda is the biggest miner. The only context to that is you can also get it from other methods. It's the biggest miner, but there's also other big fish in this environment too. You know, I think investors who know companies that like Kenmare, which produce, you know, titanium, you know, in a long distant form from the metal, you know, they're probably comfortable with this type of investment where you're buying into a you know, a niche but not niche product that has pretty broad demand drivers, but it won't be massively exciting
other than the fact it's a UK listing. But yeah, that's fair enough.
I should switch on the excitement again, because you know, we're supposed to be thankful that people are looking in our direction at the moment.
It's true. We shouldn't perhaps be so pathetically grovelling as I am for any any UK listing. It is definitely a niche investment, even notwithstanding the fact it could be in the FTSE 100. But when it comes down the line in a few weeks or months, yeah, we can take all those opinions on board and see how it does trade, as you say. Final segment today. Very briefly, we should probably talk a little bit about crypto, just because there's been a lot of news flow this week. And I say briefly, we will give it a fairly swift rundown. But there's been in the US, there's been you know, regulatory action, more of a regulatory crackdown on Coinbase for one, but not limited to Coinbase. And in the UK as well, the FCA has come out with some of its own pronouncements today. Alex, can you maybe say a little bit more about the FCA for starters?
Yeah, I, you know, love for Hermione to jump in and give us the smart person's take on this as well. But you know, the FCA is basically saying it really wants people to know that they're kind of out in the wilderness buying coins. I mean, it's a really well established infrastructure around buying crypto now that you know, compared to 5-10 years ago, even, you kind of really had to know your stuff to actually buy it. But now, you know, with the almost mainstreamification of crypto, it's quite easy to just, you know, jump on an app and buy some. You know, I think the FCA said that 1 in 10 people in the UK had done that. And now they're just really wanting to make clear that, you know, it's not a protected investment. You don't, you know, there's not a lot behind what you're buying. Just be mindful that it is a gamble. And to that end, they're tightening the marketing rules. Referring people will be harder, if not impossible, under these rules. I'm sure, you know, you can still text your mate and say buy this, obviously. But you know, within the platforms, that'll be tighter. And there's a cooling off period.
You won't get a bonus for referring friends. Yeah. I think is what they're clamping down on. And yeah, they're cooling off periods as well.
Yeah,
something else.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think the comparison with the US is that the SEC this week has put out these hundreds of pages of statements for Binance and Coinbase, saying that they are running exchanges illegally. You know, these are SEC rules from the 1930s that continue to govern how people buy and share. Buy and trade investments, and you know, if you're running an exchange, you kind of need to know what they say. Coinbase says that it's been trying to sort this out with the SEC, and said that the SEC ticked off its listing in the US in 2021. So, you know, why are you crying about it now? Effectively, so there's a bit of pushback. They're also selling an NFT to support the crypto industry. If you're interested, That's not investment advice. I'm just saying it's
Coinbase rather than the SEC. I presume this is.
That's right. Yeah. But yeah, it seems like quite a shift. Obviously, people lost a lot of money off the collapse last year of Sam Bankman-Fried's little endeavor, and you know, you assume that example has shown people the risks, but yeah, I guess this is the next phase.
Yeah, in the US, this is the question of whether crypto, you know, whether these are all securities effectively and therefore come under these old but still applicable rules. It certainly seems that, I mean, there are differing views, I think, in Congress in the US, as you might expect, and even among certain regulators, but definitely the SEC and at the top of the SEC and the commissioner very much anti-crypto and you know, responding accordingly at the moment. Khamani, as Alex said, we should defer to you. Your thoughts on crypto regulation?
This is certainly not a smart person take, but we have had an interesting kind of standoff in the UK about how we should regulate crypto. So we've got the Treasury Committee have called on the government to regulate crypto as gambling. And the Treasury has pushed back and said, no, financial services is the best way to regulate this. I think that some of the problem is coming from, for an individual, it does look a lot like gambling. So we've got the majority of people are losing money on crypto is what the Bank of International Settlements says. And then the FCA has got a very they're warning people that they might lose everything if they invest in crypto. So for an individual, the parallel to gambling is quite clear. But then when you start to look at it at an economy-wide level, you've got nearly as many people investing in crypto as you have in a stocks and shares ISA. And it starts to look a bit more like a financial stability risk, which I think is why the Treasury is saying that actually it is financial services that are best placed to regulate this rather than the gambling industry, which might end up actually giving crypto an easier ride.
That does bring us to the end of the show, unfortunately. But thank you to all our contributors this week, Hermione and Mark. And thank you to you for listening. We will see you next time on another Companies and Markets show.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.